I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. News from a number of fronts in the war with Iraq this hour, much of it, most of it, leads to the pending siege of Baghdad. U.S. soldiers are at the southern and western perimeters of the city, and their commanders are making last-minute adjustments on a plan of attack. Later this hour, we will look at those options and take your calls and questions. First, though, we want to turn to the latest news. Joining us from the U.S. Military Central Command in Doha, Qatar, is Anne Bernard. She's a correspondent with the Boston Globe. Hi, Anne.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks. I'm interested in hearing from you. What's the latest news from Central Command?
Well, here at Central Command, a military official was just telling me that U.S. Marines are engaged with a third division of the Republican Guard on the route sort of southeast of Baghdad, which is a big deal because they say that they've, in their previous battles, they've pretty much disbanded two divisions mm-hmm. as an effective fighting force, and now they're engaged with a third on the way to the city.
I did hear some of the reporters' questions today and got a sense that after a week of a whole lot of very specific information that in the anticipation of a move on Baghdad, that the briefers are being a little bit cagier these days.
It's true. Well, on some things, they're pretty cagey in the official briefing. They've been pretty good at offering some additional information afterwards to clarify things. We're not exactly sure the significance of this, but they also have ordered reporters to stop using Thuraya phones, a certain kind of satellite phone. And, you do wonder if that's because they want to clamp down on information a little bit at this stage.
And there were also reports this morning that at a munition site south of Baghdad, the 3rd Infantry found some thousands of vials of a white powder. Some people are saying it may be an antidote to nerve agents, something associated with chemical weapons. Were the people in Doha able to shed any light on that today, Anne?
Well, actually, they're being pretty cautious about that subject right now, just because early on there would be reports that would come out every time troops passed a chemical factory, and there's lots of chemical factories in the country. Some of them make aspirin. So I think they're being pretty cautious before they announce that this is a major find. But reporters in the field are quoting a Marine official as saying that it's a site that looks suspicious to him.
And I can imagine when and if that's confirmed that they'll make a big deal of it because it has so much to do with the reason why they're there.
Well, exactly. I mean, when they're sure, they'll certainly make a big deal out of it. Politically, that would be the biggest coup they could come up with, is if they actually find significant presence of chemical weapons.
All right, Anne, thanks so much for your time.
You're welcome.
Anne Bernard is a correspondent with the Boston Globe. We have on the line John Reppert. John's a retired Brigadier Army General, former director of the U.S. On-Site Inspection Agency and director of the Belfer Sanity at the Kennedy School of Government. And John's been on the program before talking about chemical weapons and the inspection process. Hello, John.
Hello.
Tell me, if these reports that we're seeing are true, that all these vials have been found at a munition site that was searched many, many times by inspectors. What does that tell us?
Well, it may be in an area of the site that was not accessible to the inspectors or that they failed to go into. It may be that it is part of a deception campaign, that it was designed to look like something else other than a storage facility, or it may be, in fact, that it is an inert object that is not part of the chemical regime, the weapons regime.
Do you get a sense that there is, either among journalists covering the war or the soldiers who are busy at the front, a real eagerness or anxiousness to find that smoking gun, whatever stash of chemicals can be found?
I don't get the impression that the soldiers on the front line are spending a lot of their time and effort looking into vats and refrigerators and vials for these types of things. I think that they are extremely sensitive to the fact when they find something that may be related to it, they need to inform higher headquarters immediately because of the powerful political significance that might have.
And when they find whatever it is they're looking for, will they know? I mean, I guess what I'm asking, John, is for your expertise in reflecting on what little information we have today. Does this seem like something that may be substantial, or can you make a judgment on that at this point?
It's almost impossible to make a judgment. As the correspondent said, it could be aspirin because it is also a white powder form before it's compressed into pills. But the important thing is that we have in the field units that can conduct field surveys for identification, and then if they determine that it is a potential agent, they will immediately ship a sample back to laboratories, and within 24 or 48 hours, we'll have a very accurate assessment of what the substance is and whether or not it represents a lethal threat. And until that time, it will be safeguarded to prevent any further access to that facility, both for the risk of the personnel involved or the possibility of theft of the material.
All right, John, thanks for your time.
You're welcome.
John Ruppert, former director of the U.S. On-Site Inspection Agency, now director of the Belfer Center at Kennedy School of Government. Now, Connection listeners, there are a number of other issues to be examined in the war today, but inevitably, the focus of attention swings back to Iraq's capital city, Baghdad, especially now with U.S. forces now battling at the airport at the outskirts. John Danishevsky is a correspondent with the Los Angeles Times. He has this look at what's happening at the center of Baghdad.
Well, I'm standing on my balcony in the Palestine Hotel, which has become the de facto international press center for the Iraqi side in this war. I'm looking out at the Tigris River. It's a gray, overcast day. There's very, very little traffic in the city. People are tending to stay indoors. I'm looking across at the west bank of the Tigris River where the fighting has been taking place today between the U.S. forces and the Iraqi forces over the airport and the area surrounding the airport.
Can you hear that? Can you see any of the evidence of that battle from where you are?
Yes, I've been hearing it. It's died down now. We hear the Apache helicopters going over from time to time and the airplanes. This morning, the bombing and the explosions were quite heavy between the hours, from the time it got light until about noon, and then it sort of tapered off during the day. We'll hear an occasional explosion. Not very close, about 10 miles from here, I think.
John, I know your activity inside the city is limited, but I'm wondering if you've had any opportunity to talk to people on the street, people in Baghdad, about what they're thinking in anticipation of the war basically moving into their city.
Well, I think today people are thinking, first of all, that the war has arrived at their doorstep. I think it was a real psychological blow for people to lose their electricity. It's been one of the quirky things about the 15 prior days that there's been an air of normalcy here because people still had electricity, running water. The television was knocked off the air a few times, but usually popped back up after a few hours. People felt confident enough in some cases to go to work or at least walk around their neighborhoods. But now that the electricity's turned off and the sounds of battle are so close, I think it's a psychological blow to people. And, of course, they're hearing horror stories about the number of civilians who have been harmed in the area around the airport and also about the military losses on the Iraqi side. Hospitals are jammed with people, angry relatives. So I think people are quite distressed today.
There's also lots of talk outside Baghdad about whether or not people will be leaving the city, whether or not they'll even be allowed to leave the city. Can you give us any information on that?
People are thinking about leaving the other side of the Tigris, the West Bank, and coming over to this side where there's no fighting as yet. So there's been a lot of running away from that area around the airport to this side of the river. And then some people are working their way north. Moving south takes them right into the line of the U.S. troops, but I have heard that some people are doing that as well.
John, thanks so much for your help today.
Thank you.
John Danishevsky is a correspondent with the Los Angeles Times. We spoke a little bit earlier this hour. John had to dash off to a news conference being held by the Iraqi information minister, and we've since heard from Baghdad that Mohammed al-Sahaf, the information minister, promised that tonight, and that is at any point in the hours ahead of us because it's late afternoon there in Baghdad, at some point tonight there will be an unconventional attack, something he said in translation that would not be military, that would serve as a, quote, marvelous example, unquote, of the force of the Iraqi army. Well, I'm not sure how much importance we should attach to that, given the fact that the same information minister promised that the international airport would be a graveyard for coalition forces, and that has certainly not proven to be the case. It is part of the psychological campaign that's being fought on the Iraqi side, as a psychological campaign is being certainly fought on this side. With me in the studio now, as he's been here a number of recent mornings, Owen Cote. Owen is Associate Director of the Security Studies Program at MIT. Welcome back, Owen.
Thanks for having me.
I guess it was inevitable that at some point in the days leading up to the siege of Baghdad, we would be talking about chemical weapons and whether and if and how. Your sense now of the likelihood of them being used. I've heard some people say that now that the troops are so close, it's less likely. But I'm interested to know what you're thinking.
Well, there's the sort of tactical level issues, and then there's the sort of higher level issues. And I think from the sort of higher level perspective, from the sort of politics of the war, I think people assume that chemical weapons made sense at the very last moment from Saddam Hussein's point of view. I mean, if he uses them early in the war, then he's justified the whole war in a sense. And, you know, his big advantage is the war remains controversial.
And so, as a man anxious to guard his reputation alive or dead, that would matter to him.
It would matter to him. And also, I think from the point of view of his strategy, it matters to him how the legitimacy of the Bush administration's cause is perceived. And when he uses chemical weapons, when and if he uses them, of course, the legitimacy shoots up, one would assume, because you really get confirmation that he's got this stuff. On a tactical level, yes. You know, when you're close to the other guy, you're sort of wary about using chemical weapons because, you know, they can get on you, too. But that's the kind of thing where, in the case of the Iraqi situation, you know, the concern would be with their troops, and I'm not sure at this point if that's really a concern of theirs. So I'm not sure that the tactical considerations would play a big role here. If there's a higher political purpose behind it, I think they'll do it if they have them.
And if they're able to even get that command of the front, because, of course, with the electricity going out, as John said, with all the sort of unknowable and chaos of some troops coming in, some civilians trying to get out, it might be that they won't even have the command structure in place to do that.
There's two things, actually. There's, you know, can they get the message out? And then what does the person on the other end of the message do? And we've had experience in the past where people have refused orders to do that kind of thing.
And do we have indications of it in this combat as well?
We don't. Well, you and I don't. But we do know from the very beginning of the war that the Bush administration and the Department of Defense has been quite vigorous about trying to send this signal to people, which is disobey those orders or there'll be real consequences.
And we have seen some of that, and perhaps not as much as the Pentagon would have anticipated, but an indication that it's there.
Well, yes, definitely some of that, yes.
All right, 1-800-423-8255 is the number for you, Connection listeners, to join our conversation. We're getting the latest news from Iraq this morning. Tell us whether or not you think this morning's news reports of uncovered chemicals have anything new to tell us about what the upcoming battle might look like, I can actually speak. What will the risks for U.S. soldiers and Iraqi citizens be as the siege for Baghdad takes shape over the weekend? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.
We certainly anticipate that there are forces that are inside of Baghdad that will seek to fight us at the time we choose to enter Baghdad. There will be absolutely no randomness associated with the way we make our approach. Deliberate work and carefully done.
That's General Vincent Brooks at Central Command talking earlier about the anticipation of the move onto Baghdad. I have with me in the studio Owen Cote, Associate Director of the MIT Securities Study Program, and we'll be talking shortly to James Blaker, who's served in different senior positions in the Pentagon. But let's get the latest on exactly what's happening in the move from the coast up to the capital city. Thanasi Kambanis is on the line. He's a reporter with the Boston Globe. He's in Kuwait City. Thanasi, hello.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm fine. I'm interested in knowing what you're seeing there in terms of either the 4th Armored Division or any kind of shift of new armor or supplies that you're seeing going up the highway.
I was down at Chubaik Port yesterday afternoon watching the 4th Infantry Division offloading their equipment. They started coming in at the beginning of this week, and they're going to be unloading their 30 container ships full of infantry armor over the next 10 days, roughly, here in Kuwait.
30 container ships.
Yes, these are enormous. They're actually larger than container ships. They're enormous ships with a closed hold, and then several decks on top with their tracked vehicles and other armor and helicopters. Now, this the 3rd Infantry Division is the one that's already up near Baghdad. The 4th Infantry, we're not sure what its role is going to be, but they are going to be fully poised to move in about 10 days. So they're gathering at a staging area here in Kuwait, and depending on how the conflict is shaped up at that point, they will be deployed either, you know, to go join the 3rd Infantry Division outside of Baghdad, or they could even end up being put in a peacekeeping role on the chance that the fighting has ended by the time they're ready to fight.
Danassi, just following through what we know of the methods or the plans put in place by Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld, any chance that certain units of the 4th Infantry Division might be heading up the highway, you know, as soon as they get a handful of tanks off the ships, or are they going to wait and move en masse?
I'm obviously not in a position to know a conclusive answer to that question, but we spoke yesterday with General Ray Odierna, who's head of what's called Task Force Iron Horse. That's 15,000 soldiers from the 4th Division and then 15,000 soldiers gathered from other Army units. He portrayed what they were doing as that they would move as a unit. It's obviously feasible that they could send off subsets of their group early, but he suggested that they would gather the entire task force and then deploy it as Central Command saw fit.
All right.
Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say thanks. If you've got something to add, go ahead.
Well, he spoke of the whole gamut of combat operations, and he did several times mention peacekeeping. So I think he at least keeps in mind the distinct possibility that that they will end up being used only for peacekeeping.
Okay, Danassi, we'll stay in touch. Thanks for your help with this.
Great.
Danassi Kambanis is correspondent with the Boston Globe, speaking to us live from Kuwait City. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Connection listeners, lots of news to deal with this hour. The first reports of what may be antidotes or elements of chemical weapons come across by the 3rd Infantry Division as they move towards southern Baghdad. Certain units of the 3rd also fighting for complete control of Saddam Hussein International Airport, now renamed Baghdad International Airport. Gateway to Iraqi Freedom, I think, is the subline on that particular sign, though I'm not really sure if it's up yet. Owen Cote is with me in the studio, Associate Director of MIT's Security Studies Program. James Blaker is joining us also by studio. He is currently a senior fellow at the Democratic Leadership Council in Washington, D.C., has served in a number of senior positions in the Pentagon, both for the Reagan and the Clinton administration. James, thanks for being with us.
Good morning.
I'm interested in your reaction to the flurry of news that we're following this morning, the discoveries of what may be elements of chemical weapons. Do you see that as significant?
Well, certainly it is. I think everyone kind of senses a movement toward what the military sometimes calls a culmination point, which is clearly centered on Baghdad and carries all the issues of whether or not they're going to fight in Baghdad or whether the authority structure in Baghdad will collapse sufficiently so that there really is no fight.
And your sense of given the fact that we now know where, or at least as much as we're ever going to know about how close U.S. troops are to the city, where it goes from here, a rest period, a move straight on in?
Well, it's kind of a function of how the field commanders see the situation around Baghdad. My guess, and that's all it would be, is that there will be kind of a pause period as they assemble the units that might have to go into Baghdad.
Owen, your thoughts?
Well, I do think that one thing they're doing is that as they approach the outer limits of the city, there's been this very confusing period for the last week where there have been lots of reports of Republican Guard units moving around, this unit reinforcing that unit, but then these units, you know, maybe going away. And I think they are going to push forward until they encounter resistance. They are going to push forward and establish contact with whatever is there. And if it turns out that nothing's there, I think they'll just keep going until, you know, they get to some point within the city where it would be really counterproductive to keep going. But I think there's some confusion about what lies directly in front of them. And I think the one way that they'll resolve that is to sort of probe fairly aggressively, like this seems like they have been doing for the past couple of days.
I'd certainly agree with that. When I say pause, I guess that's the wrong kind of terminology, because they really have never paused in the sense of stopping all sorts of patrolling and probing.
I wonder whether or not we can look at how the British forces have managed the city of Basra over the past week or so as an indication here, because after encountering the very first bit of resistance, the British chose not to go into that city, but basically to put a ring around it, allow civilians, if I understand what's happening there clearly enough, allow civilians to come and go. Oh, and is that an option for the U.S. commanders in how to manage Baghdad?
It's an option. It's a different situation in the sense that, first of all, Baghdad's a lot bigger. So it with the force we have, I think it's going to be harder to kind of literally
put a ring around
it the way they did in Basra. Secondly, I think the incentives to gain control of Baghdad rise up to the sort of strategic level here. I mean, this is what the details of how we do it, I'm not clear about what their goals are, but the overall objective, I think, has been all along to get to Baghdad and gain control over it and demonstrate that the regime is no longer in power. That doesn't exist in Basra. I mean, Basra is just – with Basra, you could say, you know, why bother? With Baghdad, I think there's a real premium on getting into the city.
And James, I've read that what we may be looking at is a fairly distinct difference in the way that the two different nations in the field would choose to approach a situation, that it's much more in the interest of the British Army at this point to say, no, there's no interest for us in putting ourselves at the risk of going into the city, whereas the Americans approach the whole combat theater with a slightly different attitude.
Well, I think that if there is a difference, it is tied to the different capabilities that the units have. The Americans, if they go into Baghdad, will come with a type of technology that the British don't have yet. And it's a type of technology that may change a great number of the presuppositions about what urban conflict is.
1-800-423-8255. I want to talk a little bit further about that, James, but we've got Dave on the line from Medford, Massachusetts. And Dave, with a question about chemical weapons, am I right?
Yes. I'm just wondering if it really makes sense at this time. If we found a stash of Iraqi chemical weapons, would it be in our interest to reveal that fact to the world? And I ask because, you know, Saddam is widely believed to be relying on world opinion and is being in his favor at this time, and he would lose a lot of favorable world opinion if it was found that he did have weapons of mass destruction. And we would deny him that card to play if we revealed that he did indeed have it, and would that possibly let him basically be the thing that would let him go ahead and use chemical weapons against us?
And you balance that against the U.S. political benefit of being able to say at the earliest possible convenience, Dave, that, we told you, the weapons were here.
Exactly. And along those lines, I'm just wondering if it's possible that we already have found chemical weapons and just want to keep it under wraps until either this thing is over or until he does go ahead and use them.
Dave, I this is Owen. I think that the value from an overall political perspective to the Bush administration of demonstrating that they were correct in saying Iraq has weapons of mass destruction is so overwhelming that I think it would trump, you know, these other concerns that you're right to point out. So I'd be really skeptical if they'd found some already, or I'd be skeptical if this recent find turns out actually to be chemical weapons, that they would keep it quiet. I think they'd talk about it as soon as they were sure.
Well, I agree it does have tremendous political value, but I'm just wondering, I mean, you have to look at the military cost if he did go ahead and use these weapons as a last-ditch effort, and I think that would be another consideration. I mean, you know,
Let's hear from James Blaker on this, then, Dave.
Well, I certainly agree with Owen. I mean, I can't think of a reason why, if they found these weapons, they wouldn't announce it very quickly. They'd want to make sure that they were actually the weapons that they were talking about. But I'm not sure that I don't think that knowing that they were there would change very much within the military, the U.S. military. They're going into this conflict on the assumption that they are there and that they will be used.
And I've seen the troops, as they get closer to Baghdad, being ordered by their commanders basically to work in their chemical suits rather than to just carry them around in a pack. 1-800-423-8255 is our number. James, I'm interested in something that you wrote. It was an article that I read last night. I'm going to quote you to you, if you don't mind. If the last battle is Baghdad, the U.S. will enter it knowing more about the terrain than the Iraqis do. To me, that seems almost remarkable. What do you mean by that?
Well, I really couldn't have said it better than you did. What I meant by that was related to what's happened over the last 5 or 6 years. My last job in the Pentagon, I was on the periphery of a group of revolutionary military people at the upper levels, Shali Kashvili, the chairman, and certainly Bill Owens, who was the vice chairman, and a number of other senior officers. They were revolutionaries in the sense that they were very much interested in accelerating and introducing many of the technologies that are becoming much more visible in this conflict. But what they were particularly interested in was never having to go through something that happened in Mogadishu. And in the analyses that went into after that event, some of which I was able to follow, it became clear that the key to avoiding something like that was information. They found that information that could have prevented some of the tragedy of the Mogadishu event, the Black Hawk Down syndrome, was available, but it wasn't in the hands of the people who needed it.
You're not talking about just better maps, though, are you?
Well, I'm talking about better maps, but maps which, in effect, give you a X-ray vision of a very complex terrain, particularly in urban affairs. What I mean by that is, geographical information systems on steroids. The ability to take much of the data that is available in the form of blueprints and diagrams, combine it with information that relies on very precise precision mapping from space, and putting together databases which allow people to literally see inside a city, know where the sewers are and the electric lines are and the gas lines, and know where the rooms inside a building are. That's valuable if it can be put in the hands of the people who are trying to take advantage of that understanding.
And valuable if it can be sort of updated minute to minute, that there is, you know, this pocket of resistance at this one place. And, I mean, if that comes from a satellite or if that comes from a tank commander, I mean, how does it get integrated into the laptop that every other Bradley fighting vehicle or whatever it is that's trying to read this stuff needs to know?
Well, that's kind of an interesting connection to the 4th Division. Of all the ground force units in the U.S. military, the 4th Division is probably the best designed and equipped to do that. It is sometimes called the digitized division, referring to the digital information that flows to all the units in it, or the networked division, which essentially it points to the kind of capability you're talking about, the ability to blend in a real-time basis all the information that is available from archives, from satellite measurement to the real-time sensing that is going on.
So, Owen, if this is the case, and bearing in mind what we heard earlier from Thanasi about it may being a week or 2 weeks before the 4th Infantry Division moves north, is that an indication that delaying for this kind of high-tech inner-city hardware will be, you know, on the top of the list of options for the people making the battle plans?
No, I actually don't think so, because I think if that's the case, they would have sent the 4th Infantry Division instead of the 3rd, you know, in the first place.
Instead of planning on bringing them in through Turkey, which was the original plan for the 4th?
Well, in other words, the first unit that was sent to the theater in the first place was the 3rd Infantry Division. And so, you know, if those capabilities from the Army's point of view were that significant, that would have been the first unit they'd send. I think also Jim would agree that we have to be clear about what's possible, in some cases what's possible literally right around the corner, some of the things he's talking about, and actually what's out there. And I can't remember her name. Is it Kelly Lynch, the Army private who was...
Jessica Lynch. Yeah.
You know, remember, I mean, when we talk about this total information awareness, that resulted from a wrong turn. You know, these were a maintenance group that was going down a road, and they took a wrong turn, and they ended up in a very bad place. And so a lot of the things Jim's talking about literally they're right in front of us, you know, for grasping, but they're not necessarily actually out there in the hands of the people that are actually fighting right this moment.
But if it were to come in with the 4th Infantry Division, would it be the first road test of this hardware in a situation like this?
Yes, the stuff that James was referring to, the 4th Infantry Division is unique in that respect.
All right, we'll talk more about this when we come back. We have to pause for our own very short break. 1-800-423-8255. Connection listeners anticipating the siege of Baghdad, the options facing the forces there, given the news that we're hearing today. Please join us, 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. You're listening to The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. With me in the studio, Owen Cote, Associate Director of the MIT Security Studies Program, co-editor of the journal International Security. James Blakers with us from a studio in Washington, D.C. He's a senior fellow at the Democratic Leadership Council there and has worked in senior positions in the Pentagon under President Reagan and President Clinton. And, James, I should give you a chance to... just comment on the idea that this digital material or digital, what do we call it? I was going to say weaponry. It's not really, but means of communication, means of understanding urban warfare would be getting its first road test here.
Well, that's one way to look at it. I think some of the road testing has occurred earlier in bits and pieces. I referred to the Mogadishu tragedy. In a way, in retrospect, that was a road test, at least in the form of a growing awareness of the amount of information that was available and mm-hmm. could have been very valuable, but was not readily available so that it had no effect. This is a capability, I believe, that has been growing for at least a decade. And much of the planning and the background effort that goes into this kind of mapping of something that is called, you know, three-dimensional terrain like an urban area has over the decade been focused on Baghdad. Not surprising, in the Gulf War of over a decade ago, a lot of effort had gone in prior to the bombing campaign, which resulted in kind of a very different type of bombing campaign.
Well, is it your view, Jim, that the Joint Chiefs will be actually thinking quite seriously of waiting until they get more of that hardware in there with the 4th before doing an attack on Baghdad?
Well, I think it goes back to what Owen pointed out, was that the forces in the field will continually try to get a very good understanding of what the situation in Baghdad is. And if they have the opportunity to take advantage of whatever that situation is, I believe that they will do it.
1-800-423-8255. Next call now from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Jean's on the line. Hello, Jean.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine.
I want to know if the speakers could address the question of non-lethal chemical weapons. About 2 weeks ago, Secretary Rumsfeld came out very strongly in favor of them as a way of dealing with urban warfare. I know it's being talked about in Washington and in other circles. Do they think that the use of non-lethal chemical weapons by our troops...
What's a non-lethal chemical weapon, Jean?
Well, think about fentanyl in the Moscow theater. If you remember the Moscow theater attempt to the Russians attempting to release the hostages in the Moscow theater.
Right.
They used fentanyl gas, and that's a non-lethal.
Okay.
So there's a whole range of non-lethal. You could probably start with tear gas, and you could go on from that. But there's a whole range of them. They are forbidden in warfare by the Chemical Weapons Convention, so it would be a violation of the Chemical Weapons Convention. But it's very appealing to some people to think, well, we'll go in and we can't distinguish the civilians from the combatants, so what we'll do is we'll use some fentanyl or we'll use other kinds of gases in order to just disenable everyone and then pick out the civilians from the combatants after the fact. So maybe Owen and your other guests could address the question.
James, why don't you start on this? Has this been talked about in Washington circles that you've been a part of?
Well, I think it has been, and there have been considerable research and development research. I'm not sure about the development about non-lethal gases. But my guess is that the attraction of trying to use some non-lethal weapons would be focused not on gas, but on areas like acoustics, which would not be surprising if this degenerates into an urban conflict.
Now, based on what I've been hearing from reporters over the last 2 weeks, they've had their share of acoustic bombardment just with the weapons landing on Baghdad. What are you talking about that's different?
Well, I'm talking about acoustic devices which are designed specifically to try to disorient people.
Are they whistles or big bangs? I'm not sure what you're talking about.
Well, I've never experienced them, but I have seen data that indicates what they do. They play with frequencies, they can have many of the same effects that are associated with what people call non-lethal gas.
There is some technology out there that sends out a kind of very powerful low-frequency pulse that's almost like getting the wind knocked out of you, you know, out to a certain radius. But to get back to Jean's question, I would not be an expert on actual discussions that have occurred in this area, but what I would have is a strong sense that the politics of doing something in this war that would violate the Chemical Weapons Convention when the war is about bringing Saddam Hussein into compliance with UN resolutions about chemical and other related matters would seem not to me to be really, really kind of positive from our point of view. And it's not clear to me that our forces have trained with these non-lethal gases as well as some of the other technologies that are out there yet. It's not my sense that they've really done a lot of training with yet. I don't think, for example, the 4th Infantry Division mm-hmm. has, you know, done any of that. They wouldn't know what button to push. So I'm not sure I believe that it's likely that they would be used, which I guess was what Gene was asking.
Just for my own understanding of them, I would assume what we're talking about is the use of this sort of gas, if it were to even be contemplated, within an enclosed area. I mean, you couldn't just blanket a square or a streetscape with anything like this with any success, could you, or is that a possibility?
They're generally for indoors. Outdoors, you know, the weather.
As in the Moscow Theater.
Exactly, right, yeah.
All right, 1-800-423-8255. Gene, thanks for that. To Raleigh, North Carolina now, and David's joining us. Hi, David.
Good morning.
Thanks for calling.
Thank you. I enjoyed the show. I have a question for your guests regarding, from a strategic standpoint, going into Baghdad, what do does the U.S. Have anything, the coalition forces have anything to gain from going in as far as from a rapid standpoint, as far as we've heard talking recently, and of course there have already been two instances of terrorism committed against our forces. And I was wondering if your guest could comment strategically if it would be more viable for us to go in basically and go ahead and take the city rather than kind of waiting and surrounding and you know, I guess the term that the president used, smoking them out. And I'll take my answer. I'll take the answer off.
Just before you go, David, when okay. you talk about the terrorists, you're talking about, excuse me, the use of suicide bombs at cars and checkpoints. And your question is whether or not there's an advantage in moving quickly simply to kind of end that type of activity on the battlefield?
Yeah, Dick, I would just say in that type of in that type of attack, but also try to get in. I know we've got the special forces and elements that are inside Baghdad. I mean, at least that's what's been reported in the media. Supposedly with the opposition forces and whatnot that are on the ground getting the information, and obviously there's a lot that we in the American public and the world public don't know exactly what's going on inside. Mm-hmm. And I guess it's the not knowing that is the worst part. And if it would be more viable for us to go ahead, we've taken the airport, or at least we're close to fully right. taking the airport and going in and kind of getting things, calmed down, I guess is probably the
all right,
lack
Dave.
Of a better term.
That's a good
thank
question.
You,
now, thank you for your call. I'm going to start with James on this one and ask you, James, if you can imagine us into a room at the Pentagon where the debate's taking place. Is there likely to be a big push for moving quickly and an equally strong desire to wait a little bit and do the kind of pinprick testing of Baghdad defenses that Owen was talking about earlier?
Well, I don't think that debate would be resolved in some office inside the Pentagon. It's more likely to be resolved in the field
okay.
By the senior commanders with the approval of an office in the White House.
Mm-hmm.
But there's the reason Baghdad is so central to the campaign, if I understand what has been said about it, is that is the center of the regime's authority. And this campaign has been devoted to trying to collapse that authority. So there are a number of ways that could happen in Baghdad, which do not reflect the notion of simply going in with tanks or infantrymen and fighting house to house and leveling the city. A lot of it has to do with this notion of knowing an awful lot about the city. The city does not contain a homogeneous population. In some respects, maybe it's similar to cities in the United States 50 years ago, complete with neighborhoods that are associated with different groupings, in some cases different tribes. That's where an awareness of the infrastructure within which the people are lodged becomes very important, because it becomes possible to think of the city in terms of details, in terms of isolating certain areas of the city without necessarily going into them. If you understand the entrances and exits from an area, and I don't mean just the streets and mm-hmm. things like that, but everything that goes in or comes out of it, then you can control that area, or certainly influence it highly by from the outside. And I think that the decision on how to handle Baghdad will be driven largely by the central purpose, which is how do you collapse the authority regime that happens to be lodged primarily within Baghdad today.
Oh, and let's just imagine for the sake of this argument that they do push, that the 3rd Infantry pushes against the sort of imaginary walls of Baghdad and meet very little resistance, as it appears they have met very little resistance at the airport. Do they just keep pushing?
Well, at this point, you would assume that there's been a more specific objective identified for what it is that they want to achieve in the city of Baghdad. And Jim was talking about some of the kinds of things that you can do in a general sense.
Mm-hmm.
I think the main debate that people have had has been between gaining control of the clear symbols of the regime's authority and in a sense becoming the new regime. And then another approach, which doesn't necessarily contradict it, it's just an additional approach, which is to gain control physically over what it is that makes the city tick, the water system, the electrical system, broadcasting system, various services like that, so that if you're an Iraqi civilian and you're interested in those services, you have to come to the U.S. military for their provision. And so there's kind of, depending on what those goals are, I think the answer is yes. If the 3rd Infantry Division and the Marines, you know, push and push and push, and it turns out that there's not much in front of them, I don't think they'll stop. And the only reason why they would stop would be if they haven't fully worked out what those objectives are yet.
Jim, we have to factor in, I suppose, the Republican Guard here, because it, as opposed to just fighting back against the 3rd Infantry, if they choose to imprison the citizens of Baghdad, not let them come out for water, this further complicates it. I mean, although there are reports of surrenders today, the Republican Guard has options.
Well, I think you're right. It's not just the Republican Guard. It's the other elements of the regime and other elements of the military. The problem with urban warfare has always been really twofold. One is the terrain. How do you operate in something that is complex as a city? And the other one, of course, is how do you separate the innocent from the people that you don't consider innocent? They are related. The terrain, if you can control portions of the terrain, you can have influence and make it easier to separate the innocent from the enemy in this case.
Well, we'll be watching over the weekend. We may well know within a day or two how that's going to play out. James, I want to thank you for joining us on the program today.
Thank you.
James Blaker, Senior Fellow at the Democratic Leadership Council in Washington. Owen Cote, thanks again, as always.
Thank you.
Owen is Associate Director of the MIT Security Studies Program. We also had on the program John Danishevsky from the LA Times, joining us from Baghdad, and Bernard in Doha, Qatar, Thanasi Kambanis in Kuwait City. They are both with the Boston Globe. We also chatted earlier in the program with John Ruppert, Executive Director of the Belfer Center at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University. Tara Murphy's our senior producer. My name's Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.
To purchase CDs or cassettes of The Connection, please visit us online at theconnection.org or call 1-800-909-9287.